You are what is known as an Afrikaner, as opposed to a South African with an English background. And I know that you teach Afrikaans and modern literature at Rhodes University.
That's right.
The biographical material here. What is Afrikaans as a subject? What do you teach?
Well, my part of it mainly concerns literature. And it is obviously a very young and very modern literature because it goes back only to the end of the 19th century. What makes it interesting is that it means that in the course of one century it really had to catch up with the whole development of literature anywhere. It had to go through all these different phases in a very concentrated sort of telescopic way in order to try and reach the 20th century, which I think it more or less did in the 60s.
This book of essays, Writing in a State of Siege, was very helpful in giving me background because you lay out a lot of historical information that I think is very important to know, and a lot of Westerners somehow tend to overlook South Africa, do not know as much as they should about that country. So I'd like for you to tell me a few things about South Africa and about Afrikaans. For example, the Afrikaans language, it's a form of Dutch.
Yes, it derives from Dutch, and Dutch speakers can understand it with a measure of difficulty. I think the relationship between Dutch and Afrikaans at the moment is more or less comparable to that between, say, Italian and French, or Swedish and Danish. So they are distinct languages, but with a lot of links between them. Afrikaans started really as a result of non-speakers of Dutch, especially slaves, Malay slaves, trying to speak Dutch and therefore creolizing it to a large extent. And then there were all sorts of indigenous influences on it from the indigenous languages and from the language of other people like the French and the Germans who also came to South Africa.
You speak Afrikaans, obviously.
Oh yes, yes, it's my mother tongue.
And you write in Afrikaans?
I constantly write in Afrikaans too, yes.
But you have been producing your books in English?
Alongside of Afrikaans, because I really started writing English as a sort of accident when in the early 70s my novel Looking on Darkness was banned in Afrikaans, and until that stage I had been writing exclusively in Afrikaans. But suddenly with that ban I found myself totally cut off from my whole readership. And it is a most devastating experience for a writer suddenly to discover himself without readers. So in order to survive as a writer, I had to switch to another language. Not in the sense that I abandoned Afrikaans, because to me, because it is my mother tongue, it is immensely important to continue writing in it. But at the same time, as a writer, I find it fascinating to operate in two languages and really work through every book from two different angles and experience them in completely different ways. And there's a sort of cross-fertilization going on all the time.
Do you write in Afrikaans and then translate to English, or do you write independently in English?
It's more or less in between. I start writing in Afrikaans, generally. And then after several drafts, I translate, which is more reworking the thing in English, and then take that through several drafts, and then very often rework it into Afrikaans from there. But in the case of a novel like A Chain of Voices, where I had about 30 different narrators, I wrote initially in Afrikaans for some of the narrators and in English for others in order to get different distances between myself and what was going on paper. So it really depends on the book I'm writing, what procedure I'm following.
English is the dominant language in South Africa.
In the sense that it is the lingua franca of the majority of the population, yes. But Afrikaans is the language spoken by the largest minority group. It may, in fact, just be beaten into second place by Zulu.
Is that right? But in writing in Afrikaans, you do automatically limit your potential audience.
Oh, certainly, yes. But as a South African, operating first of all in South Africa, inevitably the people I address myself to in the first place are the Afrikaners, because they are in power, they are responsible for what is going on in the country. They put the final touches to apartheid, which initially, interestingly enough, I think was devised by the British colonizers. And it means that through my language and my culture, whether I want to or not, I belong to the Afrikaans section of the population, and these are the people I want to reach to help them see what is going on, what we are doing.
Now, you've just mentioned that at least one or more of your books have been banned, and yet this must be a relatively new phenomenon, because in your book of essays you mentioned that books written in Afrikaans had been more or less ignored in terms of censorship by the South African authorities, whereas material written in English has been subjected to widespread censorship.
That was true until the early 70s, because the authorities seemed to be of the opinion at the time that even dissident and strongly critical works written in Afrikaans really still emanated from the dominant group, from members of the family, even if they were recalcitrant members. But once they'd crossed that very decisive line and banned the first Afrikaans novel, which was My Looking on Darkness, Afrikaans works seemed to become easier prey than English ones, and then Afrikaans had a harder time than English in the country, which lasted until about the end of the 70s, when the whole censorship system, in fact, was overhauled and liberalized for politically expedient reasons. The government simply became sophisticated enough to realize that bans reflected worse on them than on the authors. And nowadays they're trying to give us more scope and freedom.
André Brink, the literary community in South Africa, is there a split between the Afrikaans and the English, or has it come together pretty well because of the battle against censorship?
That is exactly what happened, yes, because for a very long time, until in fact the early 70s, I think, there were three very distinct streams of literature in the country. Indigenous black languages, although I think I should link to this black writing in English too, because that was very distinct from what was written in English by white writers. And this indigenous white English literature was the second stream, and Afrikaans was the third. But as a result of having this common oppressive enemy, censorship specifically, a wonderful sense of solidarity has been developing among writers of all groups. And today I think there is this feeling of belonging together, which is very important for writers in a tremendously isolated society like South Africa.
Tell me why South Africa does this. The Publication and Entertainment Act, for example, which has been used to keep books off of shelves, to keep motion pictures out of the theaters. In the United States, it's against the law to censor anybody. Mm-hmm. You can't do it constitutionally. Not that it hasn't been done in the past, because societies change. Society obviously reflects the desire of the people. And since the 1960s, there has been a great degree of independence in this country, and a non-censorship movement is very much apparent. Why is South Africa doing this? Here is an English-speaking, Afrikaans-speaking nation, a non-communist nation. There are some democratic principles still in effect in South Africa. Why is a Western nation like that practicing censorship and repression in the way that it does?
I think censorship is characteristic, symptomatic of political insecurity and of a tendency on behalf of the, or on the side of the, on the part of the government towards the authoritarian. The reason why censorship was instituted in South Africa, I think, was exactly the same reason why it was instituted by Franco in Spain and by Salazar in Portugal, etc. And I think the moment a regime really starts liberalizing, the fact that censorship becomes lifted is generally one of the first symptoms of that. But I think in that case, having said this, I must immediately point out that South Africa seems to be a strange exception to this rule at the moment, in that censorship has been liberalized to an amazing extent over the last few years, whereas the government is creating the impression of liberalizing its whole political system, but in fact is imposing it to a worse degree than ever before. Censorship, the Censorship Act is not applied as stringently as before, simply because the government has other means at its disposal to get at writers and to intimidate them.
Such as?
For instance, if you have a play which is critical of the regime, it is very difficult to find a theatre for it, because suddenly the moment you want to book a theatre, there are no vacancies to be had, and even though the next person who comes in to book the same dates which have just been announced as unavailable may find a booking for that. Especially black authors are constantly being intimidated by the security police. There's harassment, it goes to the extent of detention without trial and so on. The government uses its muscle to try and intimidate even white writers. For instance, very recently in South Africa, a few of us Afrikaner intellectuals started to work towards the launching of a new critical magazine, and we got private backing from a leading industrialist. When the government found out about it, a cabinet minister flew up to Johannesburg, had a meeting with this man, reminded him of the fact that he and his company were dependent on licenses and things like that, and the grant was withdrawn. So we had to find money from other sources. There are all sorts of ways to intimidate people and simply to make it more difficult for them to write and to operate.
Andre Brink, in your new novel, The Wall of the Plague, you write about a young colored woman. I have to use that phrase in quotes because in the United States we don't use the term colored, but it does mean in South Africa a person of mixed blood. And you write about her relationship with two South African expatriates, one white, the other black, and you couple this relationship with the project to make a motion picture based on the Black Plague. And I just wonder, it would seem to me that you're using the Black Plague as a kind of a metaphor for the plague of apartheid in South Africa. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And not just racism in South Africa, but racism in a sense everywhere. And it points to a diseased state which can threaten in one form or another any society in the world, I think. Because the idea of the plague and illness, which used to be regarded as a sort of affliction imposed by God, can nowadays be cured through medical remedies because people have grown more sophisticated. And I think part of the idea is that rather than regard racism as simply an inexplicable evil which one has to try and get rid of by ostracizing people suffering from it, one should see it as a sort of illness and try to cure people of it and develop rationally through this unfortunate phase in human evolution.
Has your metaphor been disguised sufficiently as not to rankle the authorities in South Africa? Or doesn't it matter anymore since there's a liberalization of toward censorship?
Yes, I think it's not so important to have to mask it very much, but I wanted to mask it to such an extent that it could still be recognized immediately as referring to South Africa and the particular plague afflicting it. But one of the reasons why I set it in France was specifically that over the last number of years I've become more and more agonizingly aware of the fact that racism is really rampant all over the world, and I've been distressed to see the extent to which it has been rearing its ugly head in European countries, for instance. And I know that it continues to be a very real problem in the States, although America has made wonderful advances in that particular field. But although through my being shaped by the South African society, I constantly have to draw on that experience and refer to it, I think it is very important that in pointing a finger to South Africa, in attacking South Africa, which is necessary, one should never allow that action to blind oneself to the wrongs and iniquities in one's own society.
Well, when you mention the United States, though, there's a substantial difference between the racism that may exist here in some areas and the racism that exists in South Africa. In South Africa, it is state-mandated racism. Racism is not permitted by law in this nation. It might have been under feudal statutes that the southern states had adopted, all of which were unconstitutional and all of which were found to be unconstitutional after a great struggle. So it's a big difference when you're talking about racism in this country. It's not officially mandated, and it is in South Africa.
I absolutely agree with you. South Africa is the only country in the world where racism is legalized and institutionalized into a whole formidable iron network of laws regulating every aspect of one's most private life. But that is, I think, among other things, why I said that the states have made enormous progress in that respect. I think that also explains to a certain extent why I have chosen to be a novelist rather than a politician, not just because I'm more or less impractical by nature, but because I think politicians can change legal systems, they can change laws, they can change the official system according to which people are supposed to live. But unless the minds and the hearts of people are really changed from the inside, the changing of laws in itself may go so far and no further. And I think a novelist addresses himself to that part of very private experience which is concerned with how one sees the world, how one feels about the world. And I think there one can, and I know from the sort of testimony I've had in many letters from readers, one can achieve this sort of effect. If I get a letter from a student saying that until I read this particular book of yours, I never thought of blacks as human beings, it is a terrible admission to make. But if that is the sort of discovery that readers do make through their reading, then I think what a novelist can do, although one should always be very humble about the extent of it, is indispensable in society.
Yes, a novelist can certainly touch one's heart as well as his mind. Do blacks in South Africa still have to carry these identity papers?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The pass laws are still in operation. There's talk at the moment of unifying it to the extent that everybody in the country, white and black, will have to carry the same sort of pass. But, of course, in practice, I don't think any policeman is ever going to ask a white man to produce his pass. It will just be a way of camouflaging it. The government has become a past master at camouflage and illusion and confidence tricking.
What would happen if the blacks in South Africa just refused to carry these identity cards, all of them?
Well, that's what they tried in 1960 when the Sharpeville massacre occurred. And the problem is at the moment the police repression is so brutal. I think what has happened in South Africa in the last few months since the introduction of the new constitution, since the beginning of September of last year, there's been an increase in police brutality, in the incredibly callous way in which the most peaceful demonstrations are just suppressed. And in terms of the country's enormous military power, because now the military is being used against blacks in the country as well, whereas previously that never occurred. The military used to be employed only on the borders against imaginary or real foes in other countries. But now it becomes a white-black polarization within the country itself. And in such circumstances, it is a very difficult thing for black people simply to defy the law on a very massive scale. But the interesting thing is that in spite of the dangers inherent to such an action, this is precisely what is beginning to happen, because blacks in the country seem to be driven to such a state of exasperation and desperation that they feel they've got nothing to lose and they can indulge in this sort of action. And I think this is creating a very real problem for the government.
Doesn't South Africa feel isolated from the community of nations by practicing apartheid?
Oh, it does.
By itself, you know, it just... This anger that other nations have translates itself in terms of athletics, for example. Does South Africa want to remain so apart and so lonely?
No, it doesn't. It feels very deeply hurt by this ostracization, and especially in the sports field, because I think that is the one area where boycotts, for instance, have had some sort of effect. South Africans have elevated sports to a sort of religion, and they are hit in the soft underbelly when they are cut off from the world in that particular field. So it does hurt. And even though the authorities constantly pretend that they can't care a damn about world opinion, and they seem to be justified by a sort of Calvinist rigorous approach to the fact that they are the chosen people and the elect and they are right and the rest of the world is wrong, because they're Calvinists, they have a strange sort of conscience too, and they want to be liked. They don't want to be rejected. So they are torn in two all the time, between what they believe is right and what they see as the only way to survive, which is, I think, the overriding factor, and on the other hand, the eagerness to please. Unfortunately, so far, of course, the former has had the upper hand.
Do you know Christopher Hope?
Not personally. I know his work, though. Although I haven't
read a separate development, his novel.
Yes.
Growing up in South Africa, which I don't know. It was. I know it was banned. I don't. Has it been allowed to?
As far as I know, it has been unbanned.
Has it been unbanned? You grew up in South Africa in the 40s and 50s, a period of awareness for you. What was that like, living, growing up in such a racially separated environment?
I don't think one is aware of what is really happening if you're conditioned from the very first moments of your life by a particular way of life, because nothing else is offered as an alternative. I grew up in a very conservative Afrikaans background, and I assumed the values of my society, of my community. And although during my university years I was beginning to feel a bit uncomfortable about some of the things I saw happening, no alternative suggested itself to me. And it was only when, after university, I went to Paris and suddenly was confronted with all the possibilities of the free world. And since this coincided with the Sharpeville massacre of 1960, the full horror of the South African reality was brought home to me in such a way that I had to start rethinking everything I had taken for granted beforehand.
You've taken on quite a responsibility for yourself, haven't you, being, in effect, the conscience for your native land?
I suppose one could think of it in that way, but there is not a... if one sees it in that way, there's always the danger of a sort of worthier-than-thou attitude in it. And I think what happens simply is, if one is very deeply moved as a writer by what one sees happening to one's friends and to people around you, that becomes so much part of your personal experience and perception of the world that you really write from your own heart and guts all the time. It's not wanting to be a voice shouting in the desert or calling from the rooftops or trying to pose as the conscience of a nation. One writes what one has lived through and tries to be as faithful to that experience as one can.
Well, it may not be as inadvertent as you say, because obviously when you read books like The Wall of the Plague, read your essays, you are speaking to your countrymen in a way that I hope will make them feel differently about some of the things that they're doing. I did want to ask you, and I'm probably not pronouncing this correctly, it's the movement of writers, younger writers, the Sestigers?
Sestigers.
Well, say that again.
Sestigers, that nasty guttural sound.
Uh-huh. Tell me about that.
Right at the beginning of the 60s, there happened to be a number of young Afrikaans writers about who all of us had a certain exposure to Europe. We'd all spent longer or shorter periods, especially in Paris, some of them in Germany. And we came back to South Africa tremendously depressed by the fiction scene in the country, which had been completely dominated by religious, moral, sexual, literary taboos. And having undergone the cross currents of thought in Europe, we wanted to internationalize South African literature. We wanted to write about these experiences, which had broadened our minds and our awareness. So we started writing in a much more sophisticated, cosmopolitan way. There were enormous differences between the different individuals in this group. But we had this in common, that we were all writers of fiction. and that we had this more European approach, which was, in a certain way, I think, quite dangerous too, because it meant that we regarded South Africa and the South African experience at that time really as a sort of poor relation. We were a bit ashamed of that, and we wanted to pose, perhaps, as men of the world and show to the world how much we'd been influenced by Europe. So it took about a decade before, slowly, one by one, we began to realize that South Africa was really what it was about for us, and that we had to use these tools which we had acquired elsewhere to probe and cut into our society and really explore it to the bone. At that stage, at the end of the 60s, there was a parting of the ways between a number of these sestigers. A few of us decided that the taboos we'd been breaking in terms of religion, sex, morality, and so on, had to be pursued into the political field. Others felt that art was there for its own sake, and indulged in more and more abstruse sort of intellectual puzzles on which marvelous doctor's thesis could be written, but which had very little appeal to the ordinary reader. But in the course of the 70s, gradually even those writers turned more and more towards the South African socio-political experience and explored it each in his own different way.
What was it like? What did you feel like when you found your own work barred, prohibited?
I think it was one of the most numbing, destructive experiences of my life. It was really as if somebody kicked me in the guts. Suddenly to find that you can't communicate with readers because the book has been taken away from you. And in that particular case, Looking on Darkness was a book on which I'd worked for 8 years. It represented everything I felt and thought and lived through in the course of 8 years, and to see this taken from me was, I think, a mother whose child has been killed must feel something like that. But at the same time, the rage was not impotent. I wanted to do something about it. I wanted to prove to myself, first of all, that I could not be silenced in that way. I had to find a way out, which was why I started writing in English, too.
Henri Brink, I have to give Summit Books a thank you for introducing me to your work, and I want to read more. I would like to talk to you further when you have forthcoming expeditions back to the States, and I'd like to keep abreast of what's happening in South Africa. I want to read more of your material, and I thank you very, very much for spending some time with me to talk to me this afternoon.
Thank you very much.